Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Sooner or later, we all have to grow up. But exactly what that process entails can vary dramatically. On this week's show, we're investigating growing up, a process that author Kelly Brown refers to as adulting. Veganism featured broadly in Kristen LaJeunesse's adulting. She honed her grown-up identity traveling alone across the U.S. in search of vegan food. And here's the spoiler. Tattoos were also involved. Then, the Lee brothers share their story of how the boiled peanut sparked their Southern food empire. We're traveling from childhood into adulthood on this week's Louisiana Eats. There are few people in this world who can say that bartending has taken them to all but one of the seven continents. Born in a tiny village in the Czech Republic, Zdeněk Kastanek began serving drinks at the tender age of 17. And 13 years later, his bartending prowess, creative genius in cocktail innovation, and pure ambition has taken him behind some of the most glamorous watering holes across the globe.
I was fortunate enough to start when I was 14 as an apprentice chef in one of the little three-star family-run hotel.
So first you were cooking?
Yes. Cooked in this hotel while I was still at school, obviously, and then kind of fell in love with it. And really that was like kind of what I wanted to do. I was like, I'm going to be chef. And when I was 17, I was again lucky enough, and I was asked by a young company, five guys in one of the big cities. They were opening bars and restaurants, and at that time I was doing competitions with International Bartending Association, IBA, and they saw me in one of those competitions and asked me to come over and help them to kind of not run the bars, because I didn't have any expertise in that, but help them to make it maybe a little bit better.
And then how did the wandering begin?
Well, I always wanted to wander around the world. It was kind of something what my mom keeps saying that I kind of show signs of it since I was little. I'll be always doing something on my own somewhere. And when I finished my school, the first plan was that I'm going to go straight away. Because when I was between second last and my last year, I kind of packed my bag for summer holiday and went to London on a bus. It was 26 hours. At that time, I had no money for flying at the time. So I took a bus from Prague to London. As I found out very quickly, I wasn't the only one having that idea. And when I kind of tried to get any job, the only couple of sentences I knew in England and English,
yes,
that said, hello, my name is Zdeněk Kastanek. I'm from Czech Republic and I can work here for 2 months because I have to go back to finish my school.
Good. So you got those two sentences.
That one.
What was the job you took with two sentences?
Well, I scored Subway job. That was the first one. But they
Subway sandwich?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my gosh.
They told me that, look, if we're going to give you a training and everything, it's going to take some time. And by the time you finish the training, you have to go back because you have to finish your school. There's kind of no point for us to give you a job because you have to leave anyway.
So how did you negotiate that?
Well, I didn't. I had no English. So I was like, okay, fair enough. There's nothing else I can't do then about it. So I spent 3 weeks trying, and then went back to Czech.
After getting his first taste of the big city, Zdeněk didn't wait long before leaving his village again. He hit the road to the cosmopolitan center of the Czech Republic, Prague, where he took up the dazzling art of flair tending, a form of entertainment bartending that involves performing mesmerizing tricks with bottles and shakers and other crowd pleasers.
you're 17, 18, 19, single, lots of girls at the bars. And, you know, if you can show off a little bit to score numbers, that's what you do.
Yeah, I bet.
So that was kind of thing which most of the young bartenders did at the time. The biggest example is, like, you've obviously seen Cocktail Movie. And that bar was freestyle bar, so we had three synchronized shows. The Hippie Shake from the Cocktail was one of them.
Wow.
So I was doing that for a year, kind of build it up to actually being a bar manager of that bar. And when I kind of hit that, I was like, okay, I don't think that there's anything else what I can achieve.
I'm not going to spend my life in flair bartending.
Exactly.
From there, Zdenek returned to classic bartending, to a world of white jackets, gloves, and some of the most upscale clientele. There, he met a living legend of the Czech bartending world, George Nemec, who would become his role model in the craft of cocktails. Little did he know that this mentorship would quickly transport him to bartending down under.
6 months later, we, with all our visa and all of the paperwork we needed, we landed in Sydney. And as I had no English, there was no really any job I could do which would involve talking to anyone.
I see.
From bar manager from Prague, I went right down to the beginnings and was an ashtray polisher.
Ashtray polisher.
Yes. So I moved into bar baking in 2 weeks and went to school every day, Monday to Friday, to English school, 8 o'clock in the morning till 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Had my lunch, had my little nap, and then straight to work and then bar back from 5 till 2 a.m. Sleep, 4 hours of sleep, back to school, like that for 3 months. But yeah, in 6 months, I scored a full, as a junior bartender, job.
With each job came a new learning opportunity for Zdenek that soon elevated him to the upper echelon of cocktail bars in Sydney. Zdenek was soon recognized for his vision and recruited to teach emerging bartending talent in Australia. So now you're a trainer. So
yeah.
How many years has it been since you were an ashtray polisher?
This is 2 years. Up until today, I still don't know how the hell they kind of trusted me that I'm able to. I remember my first trainings, and half of the training I actually had to fully memorize. But as you do it over and over and over and over, you kind of learn and grew from there. And I was 23 at the time. So it was time to leave again.
Now, worlds away from his humble beginnings, making Subway sandwiches in London, Zdenek returned to the UK and began vying for jobs in top hotels and exclusive members-only clubs.
Okay. I went over there and helped. Give it to my little check spin, I guess, to it.
Your checks. What is the check spin exactly?
I don't know. I got asked many times. I have, few bullet points of what I always do or the way how I live my life.
I have a few rules. Tell me the bullet points.
I hugely believe that if you want to be a bartender or anyone who hosts people, you have to be, first of all, you have to be a good person. If you're trying to host anyone for any other reason than your passion, you're always going to fail. It's very hard to act like you really mean that you're hosting someone if you do it for money.
You need the sincerity.
Yeah, exactly. There's one book which kind of helped me to, in a funny way, to understand what it means to be a good person, and it's Robert Fulghum wrote, All I Need to Know I Learned in a Kindergarten. If you haven't read that one, read it. And yeah, don't lie, don't steal, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If you have all of those manners or you have all of those rules and your team can see that and follow that, then you surround yourself with same quality people. Then anyone who walks into your bar or your restaurant or your hotel will feel that.
Zdenek's humble Czech spin on true hospitality won him a flawless reputation among the celebrity patrons of the members-only bar scene in London. At the age of 25, Zdenek was swept up by a man who Zdenek calls the Prince of India, Ariad Boss, and recruited to be a road tour trainer. Without hesitation, Zdenek picked up his life again and moved halfway across the world to train bartenders in the finest hotels across India.
It was definitely another great experience. We managed to train or managed to get 900 bartenders into our classes in 6 months.
Fantastic.
And in the middle of that, I got a phone call from Singapore, from this amazing bar called 28 Hong Kong Street. One of the partners there, Michael Callahan, who I met in New Zealand a couple of years before, he said, look, we have a plans to open this little distribution company. We want to bring it to the next level. I need your help. Are you interested? And as I was finishing that Skype, 9 hours later, I landed in Singapore.
This move to Singapore brings us to where Zdenek is today. He's the general manager of Proof & Company, an elite distribution business that's helping to shape the preeminent cocktail bars of Singapore. I asked him to describe the bar scene in Singapore for our Louisiana Eats listeners.
Singapore's a very interesting one. 1965 gained independence from Malaysia. And at that time, they were a third world country and really, really on the verge of bankrupting. 49 years later, they're the third richest nation in the world. So loads of bars are opening, lots of restaurants are opening, lots of big chefs are opening their restaurants in Singapore or around that area. So actually drinking scene and foodie scene is brilliant and very vibrant, very young. But kind of going a million miles an hour at the moment.
So, Zdenek, tell me, I go to 28 Hong Kong Street to your bar. Describe the experience you're going to give me there.
When 28 opened, I think that the whole idea was just to open what you would normally call neighborhoody bar in America, but doing it in a new market where no one really knows what the real good cocktail drinking scene is, or in any way what good bars are. So we kind of wanted to open this place without saying, here we are the best, or we are brand new and no one else is same as us, and you all have to come over here and be blown away.
Yeah.
We wanted to open it in a way like with another 20 great cocktail bars. And it's normal in Singapore to go and drink cocktails. Kind of like make the guests to feel that they're already educated in that way. The culture's always different. And if it's very money orientated, which that part of Asia is, then you can see it on your guests and the way how they just, you know, in a way, they're really going against what I believe is to be a good person, which I always say to everyone, if you want to really know what this person is about, take them to a place which you know has a bad service, and you see how that person treats that bad service or that waiter.
How the person reacts.
If that person's rude and arrogant, then you know that you don't need to be around that person. But you know, if that person is understanding and it's like, oh, it's okay, it happens to everyone, don't worry about that, I'm fine, I can wait for my dish in another 20 minutes, etc., then you know it's a good guy.
Yeah.
The culture is always hugely different.
Fascinating. Well, you describe yourself now as a spirits evangelist. What is that?
Okay. When the distribution company was in the plans, we created a whole part of the business which was all about education and basically how we're going to make sure that, you know, all our clients kind of love what we do and how we're going to help them to succeed with their businesses, which is actually the core point of our business. So we do from drawings of stainless steel work to recommending all of the machinery and brands and to creating cocktail lists to sourcing things like champagne yeast if you need them for whatever reason, to actually distribute the alcohol. And the spirit evangelist is the actual person who is responsible for you as a client. So 2 years ago, we had zero clients and zero bottles sold.
And how many today? How many clients today?
Many. I'd just say it's around 100 in Singapore.
Must be very exciting to work every day.
It is, yes. It's definitely not waking up in the morning feeling bad that you have to go to work. It's like, okay, another day. What can we achieve today?
Zdenek Kastanek, spirits evangelist at Proof & Company in Singapore. When we come back from a short break, Kelly Brown will join us to talk about a life process she describes as adulting. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. When do you know you're an adult? If you're in the process of developing into a grown-up or just need some refreshers, Kelly Williams Brown has the ultimate guide. Her first book, Adulting, How to Become a Grown-Up in 468 Easy-ish Steps, contains several pieces of advice, many of which pertain to the kitchen. We recently spoke with the Louisiana-born blogger and author about her journey into adulthood, as well as tips on how to be an outstanding host. Kelly, what is adulting?
Oh, that's such a great question. It has absolutely nothing to do with adultery. I want to say that right off the bat.
Thank you.
So adulting is a word that I made up, and it's a combination. It's sort of making the word adult, which is usually a noun, into an active verb. So it's the act of being a grown-up, which a lot of people think, oh, I'll never be a grown-up. I can never do all that. You have to do X, Y, and Z to be a grown-up. And my argument is like, no. Just every moment, try to make the more adult decision. Just do it on a day-by-day basis, and you can be a grown-up.
At what point in your life did you realize it was just time to start adulting?
I'd say for me, the real sign came when all my furniture had melted in the rain. This is the danger of buying particle board furniture and living in New Orleans. The day I was moving out, I had staged all my furniture outside and it had just fallen right apart because it was not built for the rain. So then when I got to it was my first adult job. I was a newspaper reporter in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. I did not have any furniture. All I had around my house was these piles of clothing, like beanbag chairs, except made of my dirty clothes. And I just thought, whatever you're supposed to be doing, you are not doing it right now. Let's get it together. And so for me, it was 22, 23 when I was like, there is no more excuse to not have furniture, to not know how to cook a chicken breast, to not know what to say in a condolence note, to not know how bleach works. You need to master these things. You can do them. They're not rocket science.
Well, I knew you were on the right track when I read the book, and I discovered that in a ranking of 468 steps, you introduce the importance of cooking by step 59. How did it rank so high?
You know, cooking is just one of those things that if you don't know how to cook at least a little bit, then you're either going to go hungry or you're going to eat McDonald's every day, and that's not going to be so great either. And one of my friends is what I call a great weekday cook. You know, I'm a pretty good dinner party cook where I have those things mastered. You know, when I'm going to spend all day, I'm going to spend $80 on the ingredients. But just in terms of sort of being able to come home on a Wednesday night and have everything you need to toss together a good, nutritious, tasty meal in 30 minutes with everything on hand. For me, the thing that really brought me to sort of the weekday cooking was just realizing that, A, you know, obesity in America being what it is, the more natural my foods are, the more that it resembles food that humans should actually be eating. You know what I mean? Whether
yes.
It's just chicken or shrimp or, you know, vegetables, the better I'm going to feel. And also the less money I'm going to spend. And just even being able to do something as simple as, you know, put some ingredients and a pork shoulder in my crock pot in the morning, turn it on, go to work, come home, and have that meal is such a satisfying thing.
You open the door and you know that mom's not in the kitchen. grown-up Kelly has been in the kitchen, right?
Exactly. Oh, let me tell you, there is nothing better than coming home to a house that smells like delicious meat. I don't care who, well, maybe not for vegetarians, for everyone else in the world. You come home to some braised meat and you know that you've done something right.
Well, I'd like for you to walk us through the steps of how one becomes an adult in the kitchen.
So I think the first step to becoming an adult in the kitchen is just to establish those good grocery store habits. And there's a few supplies that you're going to need on hand before. You're going to need a good small saucepan. You need a big saucepan. If you can get an enamel cast iron Dutch oven, all the better. That is really your MVP in the kitchen. You can do almost anything in there, from gumbo to short ribs to even just baking potatoes. You're going to want one good chef's knife. One good chef's knife can make all the difference. And you don't have to spend $1 million on it.
And you want it to be sharp.
Oh, you want it to be sharp. Know how to sharpen it. Or if you don't want to sharpen it, totally okay. Find a place in town you can sharpen it. Get a good paring knife, too. That's another really important thing. Now, for me, one of my most used implements in the kitchen, I think something great to have if you have a very limited kitchen budget, is an immersion blender. With that one thing, I can do anything from literally smoothies to whisking egg whites to even just mincing my garlic. I hate cutting garlic by hand. I feel like it gets so sticky, you never get it off your hands. Just being able to toss a couple cloves in there and zing them up is perfect.
Well, I love the point that you also made, because when you're first starting out to be an adult, sometimes your budget is just not going to make it to implement the kitchen with these things. So there's a lot to be said for secondhand.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you are someone who is good at Goodwill or whatever the best thrift shop around you might be, I mean, you will find some great old cast iron. You can find La Crusette. You can find all sorts of great things.
So you also encourage everybody to just grow up and entertain.
Yes. Absolutely. I mean, I think entertaining in the home is a great pleasure in life. And once you do it, you'll get addicted to it. You really will, because there's something so warm and so gracious about inviting people into your home, making the table look beautiful. And you don't have to start super big. Your first step should not be, I'm having 40 people over for Thanksgiving. You know, start small. Have a brunch in the morning where you make a couple frittatas, maybe a beautiful fruit plate. You can even cheat and pick up a couple pastries if there's, you know, a pastry or bakery nearby you love.
Or a dessert party.
Or dessert parties can be absolutely wonderful, too. You make some good coffee, make some French press coffee, have a dessert, have a few adult beverages for those to enjoy. You know, send the invite for 8:30 and everyone will know that they're going to eat beforehand, and then they can come over. And I will tell you, my favorite thing to do for those last little minute get-togethers where you just want to have a couple people over and you don't have a thing in the house: toffee. Here's all you have to do to make toffee: equal parts butter and sugar. All right, so put your cup of butter in your saucepan, put a cup of sugar in, just stir it up over medium heat until it smells slightly burnt and it's coffee colored. Now, you can add any number of things into this. You can put slivered almonds, you can put pecans, you can put vanilla extract, rum extract, anything in there. So at that point, when it smells a tiny bit burnt and it's coffee colored, you just pour it out onto a greased cookie sheet, maybe melt some chocolate on top. Mm-hmm. And it's a wonderful way, you know, if someone is just showing up spur of the minute, offer them a little bit of coffee and toffee or tea and toffee.
Well, over and over again, as I read your book, you just made me laugh out loud. Welcome to the grown-up world.
Oh, well, thank you. It's good to be here.
Thanks, Kelly.
Well, thank you so much.
That's Kelly Williams Brown, author of Adulting: How to Become a Grown-Up in 468 Easy-ish Steps. Available everywhere books are sold.
And you may find yourself living in a shotgun shack. And you may find yourself in another part of the world, and you may find yourself behind the wheel of a large automobile, and you may find yourself in a beautiful house with a beautiful wife, and you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
When the Lee brothers, Matt and Ted, were fresh out of college in New York City, they were broke, living in a tiny apartment, and making peanuts. Literally. To get by, the South Carolina natives started selling Southern-style boiled peanuts out of their New York City apartment. From those meager beginnings, the Lee brothers have gone on to write multiple award-winning cookbooks and become international media personalities. Matt and Ted joined me in the Louisiana Eat studio to share their journey from boiled peanuts to Southern food ambassadors.
I'm Ted Lee, and I'm the younger Lee brother.
I'm Matt Lee, and I'm the more senior Lee brother.
Oh, well, what a treat to have the Lee brothers in our Louisiana Eat studio. Welcome to Louisiana, y'all.
Thanks.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, let us start at the beginning, because really, gentlemen, doesn't it all begin with a pot of boiled peanuts?
In our case, it certainly does. We were starving out of college in New York City, at a loss for what to do with ourselves. Ted studied English. I studied art history. We weren't really getting anywhere. But the one thing we noticed and were really upset about was that there were no boiled peanuts in New York City.
Because we grew up in Charleston, South Carolina, and boiled peanuts are a big thing there. You know, from the time you're a kid, you just eat them at the ballpark, when you're out fishing, you know, anywhere you're outdoors, you're eating boiled peanuts.
Well, you know that smell when they're boiling on the stove, and it's sort of beany and mysterious and really appetizing to us, at least, growing up on them. Well, we conjured that up in a New York City tenement apartment and thought we'd sell New York on the hip snack of the 90s. This was back in the 1990s. That was an instant failure, but on the rebound, we started selling them to expatriates like us by mail order, and that hit a groove.
Yeah, what happened the first time you handed a bag of boiled peanuts to a New Yorker?
Oh, it was a catastrophe. I mean, well, first we thought we would sell them to bars and restaurants, but in New York, there was a wave of Southern restaurants at the time, but they were Southern theme restaurants. Mm-hmm. And so we walked in with our bags of wet bags of boiled peanuts, and they were just like, we didn't get past the host stand because they were like, what is that? I'm not touching that. And we'd say, but these are boiled peanuts. You're a Southern restaurant. And they'd be like, well, we don't really know the South. We're just pretending here.
So you find the expats, and you find them through the help of a friend at the New York Times, a little teeny mention.
She wasn't a friend. We just floated a letter to her with a stamp on it, and yeah. She called back.
Florence Fabricant. And she still does do the food notes, and we knew her name from reading the New York Times, and we sent her a press release saying,
and
boiled
a sample
peanuts,
then.
Now available by mail order.
And June 1st, 1994, she wrote up a little one paragraph with the telephone number of our tenement apartment, and we were in business.
Our phone started ringing off the hook with people wanting boiled peanuts, but they'd also say, but while you're getting me the peanuts, can you also pick me up a jar of fig preserves, you know, the traditional kind, not pureed, but whole with the lemon slices and the crystallized ginger. And suddenly we had the idea for a whole catalog, a whole range of Southern products that people who no longer lived in the South, maybe they were in Los Angeles or Minneapolis, they wanted those products. And so we left New York, went back to Charleston, and started the Lee Brothers Boiled Peanuts catalog.
Oh, so you actually moved home and started?
Yes.
Yeah, by the end of that summer, we had hatched the plan for a full catalog of these Southern foods that didn't travel well, and we set up in an old hotel room in downtown Charleston, and we've been there ever since in some fashion or another. In the intervening years, we've begun to dabble in writing and recipe development and publishing and broadcasting. And so what began as just a boiled peanuts business has turned, almost without our trying, into something quite different.
Well, your first cookbook, let's talk about that, because it is really sort of the Southern Bible of cooking in so many ways. You hit on every genre, every favorite, all the important things.
Well, it took us 6 years.
Yeah, it took us a long time to write.
A lot of blood.
Well, I think one of the sweetest things to me in that first book, and please give us the full name of it.
It's the Lee Brothers Southern Cookbook, Stories and Recipes for Southerners and Would-Be Southerners. That would be hinting at the fact that we don't have a Southern grandmother. Our parents grew up in New York. We grew up in Charleston, but, you know, that counts for a lot in a place like New Orleans or Charleston. But still, you know, it took guys who didn't have Southern grandmother to have the kind of perspective on Southern cooking that it takes to really appreciate it.
So the first book comes out, and it must have been an exciting time.
Yeah, we won 2 IACP awards, including the Julia Child Award, and that was a wonderful, like, we could have, you know, just quit right there. But then later in the season, the James Beard Awards happened, and we won Best American Cookbook. And that was a fantastic experience. And we ran down the aisle of Avery Fisher Hall like maniacs, and everyone laughed. And there was like 1,000 people in the audience. And we were down in the green room toasting and drinking champagne. And everyone was like, get back on stage, guys. And it turns out that we had won Cookbook of the Year.
Oh, my gosh. So, must have been a big night.
It was crazy. It was the biggest night, for sure. And it just, you know, it was just fun. It felt like a win, not just for us personally, but for the South. Like,
yes.
We did this.
Southern food and Southern recipes can be taken seriously in New York City.
Well, in your 2 ensuing books, you really took Southern food to another level, because I think you all are thinking outside the box with fresh Southern ingredients.
Mm-hmm. Well, our second book, in our first book, was very much about the classics and traditional stuff, like you mentioned. And a lot of people who weren't necessarily from the South would say when we were touring, are all Southern recipes this difficult and have this many ingredients? And we sort of felt that we sort of created this impression that every Southern cook was cooking holiday food every day. And so we wanted to do something that sort of counterbalanced that and was also more true to the way we cook on day-to-day basis when we're busy. And so we came up with Simple Fresh Southern, knockout dishes with down-home flavor. You know, it's a quicker, easier weeknight cooking kind of thing for busy people.
It's just more naturally sort of the way we cook on an everyday basis. And we're constantly inspired by the wealth of vegetables that grow in the South. I mean, we have to keep reminding ourselves, whether you're in New Orleans or Asheville, North Carolina, or Charleston, that so many things grow here. And the rest of the world and the rest of the U.S. doesn't really have that. I mean, California certainly does. But having a temperate climate with like 1 to 2 seasons, being able to grow bananas and asparagus in the same climate, and then you add to that just the richness and the bounty of the ocean, and, you know, you've got something really special to work with.
Another thing in the first book, in the Lee Brothers Southern Cookbook, we had, for a lot of the Southern icons, like collard greens or fried chicken, there was the Tuesday version or the Sunday version. Just acknowledging that, you know, sometimes we're cooking just on a weeknight and we want it to be Southern and iconic. We want fried chicken.
And
sometimes on a Sunday, you're cooking for family. You can take more time. You have more time.
Well, you all do a good job at it. And I'm curious, all those many, many years ago, when you boiled the pot of peanuts, and did you all ever think that you would end up spending your careers so closely entwined with each other? I mean, it's hard to think of a whole lot of brother teams that are quite like you two.
We just took it day by day, really.
Yeah, it's and, always been a little bit performance art. So
yeah, and also we're very different people, and you know, even today we live in different cities. Matt lives in Charleston full time. My wife and I live in Brooklyn. But we have this back and forth that I think we always had as kids, but we didn't have a lot in common when we were growing up. You know, I was into skateboards and punk rock, and Matt was into like Journey and classical music and computers.
Yeah.
And somehow we came together and our interests sort of merged, and it was really in the kitchen.
That's Matt and Ted Lee of the Lee Brothers Boiled Peanut Empire. What makes dry-aged meat special? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back.
Salt peanuts.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What makes dry-aged meat special? Dry aging makes a good piece of beef great. Why? There's three basic reasons. First, the moisture loss that occurs during the aging process concentrates the beef flavor, making it taste just beefier. Also, because as the meat ages, enzymes naturally present in the meat break down the tougher muscle fibers and connective tissues, making the steak more tender. And lastly, because of the flavor change that occurs as the fat molecules oxidize, resulting in a piece of meat with nutty, almost cheese-like aromas. It's a matter of personal taste as to how much aging you prefer. Some like a 30-day aging, while others, like me, rather the funkier flavors that develop in up to 45 days. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Kristen LaJeunesse is the author of the new book, Will Travel for Vegan Food, which documents her two-year journey of traveling around the country, aiming to eat at every vegan restaurant in the U.S. In 2012, Kristen's vegan adventure brought her to New Orleans, and I had a chat with her about the journey so far. What is your ultimate goal of making this trip?
It's kind of a multi-purpose goal. I guess initially I set out to help spread awareness about veganism and how it ties into healthy living and the environment and animal welfare. But it also is, you know, started out because I just really wanted a lifestyle change. I fell in love with food after becoming vegan, and I always wanted to travel. I always said, oh, I wish I could go here or there, but I found reasons not to. And there was just a day that I said, you know, I'm going to find a way to follow these passions that I have, which is food and travel. And it just kind of took off from there.
So where have the travels taken you so far?
I've gone down the entire East Coast, and then from Florida, from the West Coast of Florida, I went up through, Alabama, Tennessee, Kentucky, Ohio, Michigan. I went up into Toronto and then drove from Toronto over to Minneapolis and then back down until I got here.
Well, now you're in New Orleans. How are you finding the food scene here?
So far, it's been great. I haven't been here for even a full 24 hours yet, but I did have dinner last night at the Wandering Buddha, which is a 100% vegan restaurant. And I had a really nice conversation with the owner last night, too, while I was there, who recommended some other vegan places around. And compared to other major cities and states, Louisiana has a ways to go in terms of offering a lot of vegan stuff. But New Orleans is the only city in the entire state that has any vegan food.
Really?
In terms of 100% vegan restaurants, yes.
Now tell me, can you ever imagine going back to eating meat?
Absolutely not. I have fallen in love with this lifestyle. There's nothing about it that deters me. And in fact, 2 years ago, I was vacationing in Chicago, and I decided that I wanted to make this statement of veganism a bit more permanent in my life, and I decided to get a tattoo that represents this lifestyle. So on my wrist, I have the international symbol for veganism, or vegetarianism, which is a V with a little leaf on the end of it.
Now, 3 years later, Kristen's wanderlust is satisfied, and her book is finished. So I decided to sit down with her again to see how her views on life, love, and vegan food have changed. Let's talk about the dream that you had and were able to fulfill.
Sure. Well, the initial plan was to try to eat at every vegan restaurant in the country. And so I did just that. And I also had done a Kickstarter fundraiser to try to get money to purchase the van and get going, and thought that it would take about a year to eat my way through the country.
But actually it took two.
It did. Yeah.
And it was a great adventure along the way.
It changed my life. Yeah, I think at the time when we spoke last, that's when I was starting to realize just how different the journey was actually going to be or was starting to become, but I didn't know. I had no clue just how much it would change my life at the time.
And when I read the book, the thing that struck me was this book isn't really a travel book, and it's not even really so much about vegan food. What really struck me is that it was really sort of a coming of age experience, because you were a very different person when you began your journey than when you ended it.
This is true. Yeah, it's a good kind of concrete theme throughout the book is this idea that I never knew how dependent on other people I was for emotional and physical needs. For the first time in my life, I was put in a position where I was alone in every single way, physically, emotionally, spiritually even. I had never even gone down the road of spirituality so much until doing this journey. And so you're right, it changed my life in that I became much more aware of the type of person I want to be and how I want to live my life.
One of the things that just really surprised me was that I had no idea that We'll Travel for Vegan Food would focus so heavily on sex and tattoos. There were some very brave things you told. I don't know what it would take for me to write about those intensely personal things that you put on paper.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I tell my dad to skip chapter 8. That's for sure. My mom told me the other day he read the first page of chapter 8 and then skipped ahead. But I wouldn't say the whole book is about sex and tattoos. It just so happened that those were not the tattoos so much, but the sex and romantic stuff was definitely interlaced with this idea of being alone and how I was associating that emotionally, personally. And, you know, some people will hopefully be able to relate to that experience. Others might not, and that's okay, too.
You just really did have amazing, amazing experiences from one end of the country to the next. If you could come up with one defining moment, the one that you go back to again and again and think, wow, that's what that was all about, which one is it?
That's a tough one. There was a moment about halfway through the journey where I was at a wellness center in southern Arizona. And I talk about this in the book too, this moment of one of the first times I've ever meditated. I was in this kind of rock garden labyrinth thing, and it was my last day at the center. And I was feeling emotional. I was starting to understand the value of being alone. And I remember closing my eyes and putting my hands together in front of my chest and just saying, thank you for this life of mine, because I couldn't believe that I was going on this journey, that it was supported entirely by donations, that it was going off without a hitch, that everything was just falling into place. The people I met were amazing. And I still get chills when I think about it, because that was one of the moments where I understood how valuable the experience was.
Kristen LaJeunesse, author of We'll Travel for Vegan Food. While Kristen LaJeunesse has journeyed across the country in search of vegan food, Scott Gold embarked on a lifelong odyssey determined to avoid eating vegetables with his steak dinner. Scott tells us how to avoid the pitfalls of ordering just a salad with the perfect compromise, the wedge.
When I first visited McClure's Barbecue on Magazine Street just after they'd opened, I had a lengthy and genial conversation with pitmaster Neil McClure. We talked about brisket and chicken and pulled pork, about low and slow methods, seasonings and cooking times, and about the pleasures of all the different regional and southern barbecue sauces. I'm particularly fond of the mayonnaise-based white Alabama sauce, Big Bob Gibson style. It was a fun time, and the barbecue was outstanding. But one thing always tickles me when I look back fondly on that first long chat of ours. At one point, McClure tangentially noted that his unofficial motto was, "You don't win friends with salad." He even wanted that tagline to be printed on t-shirts, something that has, in fact, come to pass since that day. The line is funny, and it should be. It was taken from one of the finest episodes of The Simpsons ever written. Lisa, the vegetarian. The word salad has gained such unfavorable connotations, it seems. Meat lovers of all stripes are keen to refer to vegetarians as salad eaters, conjuring the image that those who shun carnivorous pleasures are essentially large rabbits. And the phrase, "I'll just have a salad," is met with a heaping amount of suspicion and even scorn by gourmands and gourmets alike. "Just a salad" seems to be coded language for, "I'm trying to make a good impression by appearing dainty and dietarily conscientious, and not shoving a 46-ounce porterhouse steak slathered with truffle butter and a loaded baked potato into my face." Or even, "I don't want to eat, but we're in a restaurant, and I have to order something in order to appear normal, lest some alarm go off in the kitchen and they find out that I'm actually part of an alien species which doesn't require corporeal sustenance to continue existing, as we feed mostly on human souls and sadness." That, friends, is how strange the phrase, "just a salad," seems to some people. And I get it. In many regards, a salad is not a meal. Lettuce and simple veggies alone do not a dinner make. But it doesn't have to be this way. You can, in fact, make friends with salad. It just depends on the salad. There are ways to make salad more than the sum of its parts, to make it better, to help it rise above the sad connotation of being nutrition for small, fuzzy, helpless herbivores. Take, for instance, the wedge salad. My mother, the crowned queen of taking things to their furthest possible extent in the kitchen, prepared for the family recently. We were having her famous crawfish etouffee, which was treat enough, but of course, being somewhat health conscious, she wanted to make sure we got some vegetables into our diet as well. Instead of making a simple salad to go with the rich, spicy etouffee, however, Mom decided that a classic wedge was in order. Note, it should be warning enough about the nature of the wedge salad that it has become one of the most popular salad choices in American steakhouses. And why is that? Because the wedge exists, mostly, as a topping delivery system. Here's how to win friends with a wedge. Take half a head of baby romaine lettuce. Dice some red onions and tomatoes. Place those on top. See? Healthy. Then add a whopping fistful of chopped, thick-cut, smoky bacon and slather the entire thing in creamy blue cheese dressing until you audibly notice your entire cardiovascular system desperately crying out for clemency. Serve and devour with gusto, safe in the knowledge that by eating just a salad, you need not turn in your carnivore card to the authorities. But just in case, you should still be wary of salad-only diners in a restaurant. There are aliens among us, you know. Let's not give them the upper hand.
Writer Scott Galt's Food Porn Friday column can be found each week on NolaVie.com. You don't win friends with salad. You don't win friends with salad. You don't win friends with salad. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week when we say auld lang syne to the one and only Chef Paul Prudhomme.
And I'll tell you, a great piece of fish is good cooking, good eating, and good loving. And we love you guys out there.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and by Dickie Brennan's Bourbon House. From oysters to redfish, serving fresh Gulf seafood on Bourbon Street. They're also home to the city's largest American whiskey and bourbon collection. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner and Sarah Holtz. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.